Welcome to the RICO 12 Speaker Meeting Podcast. My name is Justin, and I'm an addict. And thanks to my God, the steps, and the fellowship of other addicts, I'm sober one day at a time since June 19th, 2015. And for that, I am beyond grateful. Welcome once again to the RICO 12 Speaker Meeting. We are an organization whose addictions include alcohol, drugs, lust and sex, food and gambling, and we're adding another one today, which is really exciting, shoplifting, theft. Just to name a few, we come together from all places, faiths, and backgrounds to learn the similarities of addiction and to gain tools and hope from others who are walking a similar path. We invite recovering addicts with at least 1 year sobriety who are actively working their recovery in their respective fellowships to share their experience, strength, and hope on a live Zoom meeting each Friday at noon Central Time for 20 to 25 minutes. Then we, the live audience, get the opportunity to ask questions of the speaker for another 20 to 25 minutes. In order to ask questions, if you're here live, please type them in the Q&A link at the bottom center-ish of your Zoom window, and we'll get to those questions as we get to that part of the meeting. Now, if you're hearing this podcast recorded and would like to participate as a live audience member in the future, or even if you'd like to be a guest speaker in a future meeting, please go to www.rico12.com, that's R-E-C-O-1-2.com, to learn more and to submit your email address there to receive weekly invitations or to submit to become a guest speaker. This week's meeting is entitled When Stealing Becomes a Drug, and Terrence S. will be our speaker. Now, RICO 12 is an ad-free service, and we appreciate your help in keeping that way. We self-support. We gratefully accept contributions to help cover the costs of the Zoom platform, podcast platform, web hosting, and administrative costs. The guest speaker also chooses a fellowship or recovery-centered organization to which the majority of contributions from that week's meeting will be donated to. To contribute, you can go to rico12.com/support, or you can click the link to PayPal that is in the chat of the live meeting, or if you use Venmo, you can also contribute there. Our handle is at rico-12, spelled out T-W-E-L-V-E. When you contribute, please specify the meeting number. This is meeting number 6. Now, in last week's meeting, we heard from Castle S., who shared about the necessity of kindness and acceptance in recovery fellowships. It was a beautiful conversation with great insights. If you missed hearing that one or any of the other meetings we've done to this point, you can listen to them in podcast form by searching for RICO 12 Speaker Meeting Podcast on virtually any podcast platform that you use. Or you can go to the RICO 12 website and find it under the link podcast. Now, let's introduce our guest speaker for today, a new person in my life and network, and someone I am excited to get to know a bit better today, Terrence S. So, Terrence, here's a bit of an intro and bio for him. Terrence has been in recovery since March of 1990 from addictive, compulsive shoplifting and stealing. He is the founder of CASA, which is Kleptomaniacs and Shoplifters Anonymous, in 1992, which has support groups in the Metro Detroit area and across the U.S. Terrence has used his own experience, strength, and hope to help provide means for others who walk similar paths to him by becoming a certified social worker and addiction therapist. He is the founder of the Shulman Center for Compulsive Theft, Spending, and Hoarding in Metro Detroit. He counsels people in person, by phone, and via video from across the United States and beyond. He has authored several recovery books, which will be listed in the chat section of the live meeting and in the show notes for the podcast. Terrence has presented at many conferences across the United States and has been featured in numerous media interviews, including the Oprah Winfrey Show in 2004. I'm really grateful to present Terrence S. to you. Take it away, Terrence. The floor is yours.
Thank you, Justin. I really appreciate you reaching out to me about a month ago, and I'm excited about Recovery 12, RICO 12, and I'm looking forward to being of some hope and strength to people out there, and if nothing more, an education and resource person. If you or someone you know has a problem with compulsive shoplifting or stealing. So I just turned 55 years old in June, and I've been in recovery for 30 years, since 1990. I got into recovery, fortunately, at age 25. I'm going to attempt to be brief in giving a little recap of my story. I live in Metro Detroit, but I grew up in Detroit, and my father was a child prodigy pianist and concert pianist, and also an accomplished trial attorney. My mom was a school teacher. I'm the oldest of three sons. As I said, I'm 55, and I've got a brother who's going to be 49 and a brother who just turned 40, and they are also in recovery as well. So basically, life was pretty good up until I was about 10 years old. And my dad struggled with alcoholism and untreated bipolar 1 disorder. And that led to a lot of financial and emotional chaos in our family. My mom ended up divorcing him when I was about 11, and my younger brother was 5. And that was really hard on me. And I took over, grew up kind of early, as a lot of people probably can relate, and I took over as basically the man of the house. Mom went back to work full time, and I would watch my brother and learn how to cook and clean. So when mom got home, dinner would be on the table. And I really relished all of that help that I could give my mom and my family. But it did set in motion a kind of a pattern of trying to be stronger and maybe more perfect and more together than I really was. So it's a familiar story, but I just stuffed a lot of feelings. I had a lot of ongoing anger toward my dad. We had a big financial drop in our life where my mom had to go on governmental assistance, and therefore we did too, and food stamps and things like that. And I was embarrassed about that and worried about it. And I also felt ashamed coming from a divorced family. It's more common now, but in that day, mid-70s, late-70s, it was not as well heard of. So also my self-esteem, I felt somehow different than my other friends whose parents were still together and whose dad didn't appear to be an alcoholic. So while I hung in there and I did well in school, and I excelled in sports and I was artistic, but artistic in terms of, you know, drawing and things. And I was musical. I played the piano and guitar. So I had a lot of life coping skills and hobbies that definitely helped, but somehow that wasn't enough. And I had a growing kind of sense of life feeling out of control, of life feeling unfair, worrying about money, trying to be the hero and the strong one for my mom and my brother and basically anybody. And while it's pretty normal for a lot of young people and teenagers especially to experiment with shoplifting, and I was no exception, it's less common for people to develop an ongoing problem with that behavior. I had a persistent feeling that my childhood had been taken from me, or I might even say stolen from me, and that my authentic, natural, happy self got kind of supplanted with, you know, being very serious-minded and being very responsible, which are good qualities in themselves, but they were a little bit out of balance. And I had a number of things growing up in the good neighborhood in Detroit that were actually physically taken from me. Most people have had that experience, but they stuck with me. So I had a bike that was stolen right after I had bought it. A couple valuable comic books from a so-called friend who was trading comic books with me. A few skateboards. So not only did I feel symbolically, I think, that things had been stolen from me and that life was unfair and that maybe I was naive and it felt betrayed and violated, and you know, but it was a lot. And the key is that, you know, how many young people in their early teens are really, you know, talking about their feelings and asking for help? Certainly not me. And so I did experiment with shoplifting, probably, you know, age 11 or 12, shortly after the divorce. But it really wasn't until about age 15 when I got into high school and began taking a lot of art classes, and that required my purchasing a number of art supplies. And I did get an allowance, and I had a couple of part-time jobs, and that covered it. But sometimes I needed a little extra, and I hated to ask my mom for money because money was tight, and I certainly hated to ask my dad for money because there was always strings attached. So somehow, some way, and it was not planned out, but at this particular art supply store, I would buy a few things and maybe pocket one thing and save a few dollars. And within about a year or so, that began to be a pattern. I always knew right from wrong, and I always felt conflicted. I never told anybody about it. It was nothing I was proud of. But little did I know that this behavior was becoming at least a habit, and I had no idea that it would eventually become an addiction for me. So to kind of fast forward, after about 10 years, I'm 25, and I'm in the middle of law school. And there were times during that 10 years where I didn't shoplift at all for perhaps months at a time, and either by trying to stop it because I knew it was wrong or being occupied with other things. But I kept coming back to it eventually for one reason or another. And a lot of it was I just had this constant pressure to do well in school, to put on a brave face, to be there for everyone. And the first person I did end up telling when I was about 25 was a girlfriend I had at the time who I met in college. And she had confided in me that she was in counseling for bulimia. And I had no idea that that was going on for her. And there was an opening, and I told her, well, it's interesting you say that. I don't know how you're going to feel about this, but I've had this problem with shoplifting for a while. She was a little surprised, but not entirely, because sometimes I would take little gifts, sometimes I bought her gifts, sometimes I took gifts, but she had a little intuition. Something was going on, but she couldn't put her finger on it. So to her credit, she was non-judgmental, and she suggested that I get into therapy. You know, something was off. I was otherwise an honest person, the kind of guy, which is not uncommon with the people I've gotten to know over many years who've had this problem. If you dropped a wallet or a purse in front of me, I would have given it back. That was not my kind of stealing. But I did finally get caught, to back up a little bit, in my senior year of college in 1986. So I was about 21. And I had been taking things from this particular store, always small things. I'm not rationalizing it, but I was not a high-end thief. But I would take cassette tapes, for those of you who might remember what those are. I would take books and magazines, things like that. Rarely anything over $10. But the frequency would escalate at times. And I was finally caught, again, at age 21, my senior year of college. I was trying to shoplift under my sweater, a double cassette of Pink Floyd, The Wall. Some of you know that album, and it's a great album, one of my favorite albums. And it's all about alienation. And it was kind of poetic that that's what I got caught with. I was trying to exit the store, and they had these electronic gates that they'd never gone off before, but on this day, it went off, and I stopped right in my tracks like a deer in the headlights. I tried to get rid of the cassette tape under the counter, but I was dragged back to the back of the store, and my heart was pounding, and I felt my life was over. I was afraid of three things. One, that I would go to jail. Two, that I'd get kicked out of college right before I was going to graduate in 6 months. And my biggest fear was that my mom would somehow find out and she'd be horrified and that I'd let her down. Well, none of those three things happened, and I was able to get an attorney through the student union, and I got a relative slap on the wrist. 6 months probation, several $100 fine, keep out of trouble, and I had to do about 50 or 60 hours of community service. So I was relieved, and for a while I thought I was cured. I was really good on my 6 months of probation. I did not shoplift at all. I think I had maybe a few temptations, but clean as a whistle. Unfortunately, I transferred my drug of choice, so to speak, into employee theft. I was working two part-time jobs on campus, one at the Barnes & Noble bookstore and another at a local deli in the student union. And at both jobs, we were entitled to very generous employee discounts if we wanted to get any sandwiches or if I needed a book or a textbook, 30% discount, if I recall. And I used that up until this point when I was on probation. And gradually I got the idea of like, well, why pay anything for a sandwich? I can make it and shove it in my backpack that was in a drawer, or I could take a book instead of paying for it. I was eventually fired from both jobs. They didn't tell me I was fired for stealing, but I had the idea that they were on to me. And so I lost both of those jobs. So now I had very little income, and I'm about to graduate with a degree in English literature. And I was really a lost puppy. I didn't know what I was going to do with my life. When I got off probation, it was around the time I graduated in May of 1987. And I had no direction in my life. I had a degree from the University of Michigan, one of the better colleges in the country and certainly in the state of Michigan at that time. But I had no idea of what I was going to do for a living. I did end up going to Europe with a couple of buddies of mine after I graduated and spent 6 weeks there and lived very close to the bone. I had hardly any money to spend. So I always prided myself how, for some reason, I'm living very frugally. When I came back, I moved in with my mom in the suburbs of Detroit. We had moved out of Detroit by that time. And I worked odd jobs as a waiter, painting houses and things like that. And my self-esteem was really in the toilet. And for a year I drifted, and because money was tight and I was feeling pretty lost, I began to shoplift again periodically. And I knew the risks and I knew the consequences, but that didn't appear to deter me much. After about a year of drifting, my dad, who I'd been not exactly estranged from, but he had gotten his act together. He had remarried. I had, in 1988, I had a half-brother who was 8 by my dad and my stepmom, and my dad had stopped drinking, and he persuaded me to apply to law school. I didn't want to be a lawyer, but I didn't know what else I wanted to do, and I did want to be close to my dad, and he made it sound like a sweet deal. He said, "I'll help you with your studies. You can come to my office, and I'll you know, give you some work to do and pay you well." So that was it. I applied and got into Detroit College of Law in the fall of 1988. And I turned over a new leaf. When I got into school, my dad was there for me. And I'm thinking, you know, I can't shoplift anymore. I'm going to be a lawyer, you know, for God's sakes. But while things were going pretty well, school was a little tough. And then my dad, at age 48, suffered a severe stroke and almost died in late 1988, a couple months after I was in school. And it felt like the carpet had been pulled out from under me just as I was getting some direction in my life and just as my dad and I were getting closer for the first time in a long time. And as you probably won't be surprised to hear, within a very short period of time of my dad going into the hospital, he did live, but he was in the hospital for many months. And when he got out, finally, he was in a wheelchair and was not able to practice law or do much else. I began to shoplift again. And I felt just like in total conflict. But this somehow became my way. It was certainly an indirect cry for help. I didn't realize that at the time, but it was a way of somehow getting some kind of relief or making up for all the things that weren't going well in my life. And there were many. Now, I was never a very spiritual person or religious, but I did have a number of things that happened that were fortunate and people in my life who I consider to be guardian angels. The first one was that my dad survived. So that was one, even though he was greatly impaired. The second was that I did manage to barely make it through my first year of law school with a C average, anything less than I would have gotten the boot. So I did have a choice point about whether to continue for 2 more years, but I had no other ideas for my life and no other structure. So I continued on. I was also taking out more student loans. I had taken out loans for my undergrad, and I had taken out loans now for my college, and I was getting very nervous about how I'm going to pay that back. But I continued in law school, and I got through about another half a year. So I'm a year and a half into my 3 years, and it is March of 1990. I'm just shy of 25. And by this point, things were really unraveling. My girlfriend, who I was still dating for 3 years at that point, I cheated on her, told her about it, but we broke up. I was very upset about that and very ashamed of that. My dad was drinking again and on the verge of divorce. My two younger brothers were suffering greatly because of my dad's physical condition and his drinking. And I was muddling through law school, taking out more loans, not into it at all, but having no other idea of what to do with my life. And I also began to steal from the law school library where I had a part-time job at the front desk. We were in charge of selling Xerox copy cards for the copy machine in the library. So people could buy a $1 card, a $5 card, a $10 card, or a $20. And they really had no system there of oversight. You just put the money in an envelope. And I began to take money. Now, what I did with this money, I didn't buy anything fancy, but somehow it just made me feel more comfortable to have a little more money than I had. But also, I think emotionally, again, it was an indirect cry for help. It was obviously a distress signal. And I was, I think, filling a void, and it was somehow making me calm or feeling like I was making life a little right or a little better for myself moments at a time. You know, we all like to get free stuff. Not everybody crosses the line that I did. But the way I kind of look at it is, why wait for life to throw you a freebie when you could take it yourself? And I didn't have that all planned out in my mind, but I think that was partly what was going on. I was using it as a mood regulator. So I was in deep conflict, and I finally got to the point after breaking up with my girlfriend, or her breaking up with me, feeling like a total hypocrite stealing while in law school, very helpless and hopeless around the situation with my dad and his drinking and the marriage to my stepmom, and yet going back and forth from wherever I lived at the time to try to help him and my stepmom and my younger brother, my half-brother. So it kind of reminds me of the Michael Corleone line from The Godfather, if any of you are familiar with it. Like, I was trying to live a straight life, straight and narrow, but I kept getting pulled back into the family drama and that old role of being the hero and the giver and the helper. And it was overwhelming me. I realized later that I was going from one pole to the other. I was either being, you know, I had a very active super ego, so to say, where I was really feeling a lot of obligation and duty to my family. And then I would go and act out or steal to take the edge off. Again, I didn't have this all in my mind at the time, but I finally hit the bottom, or a bottom. I'm hoping it was the bottom so far, knock on wood, where I got to the point where I had felt at least mildly suicidal. And that, fortunately, scared the bejesus out of me and led me to come clean with my mom, who I'd always been close to. And I basically came to her and said, I think I need to see a counselor. I'm depressed. I'm lost. My self-esteem is in the dumps. I can't deal with all these things going on in my life that are going the way they are. And this was the hardest part to tell her. I then said, Mom, there's one other thing I have to tell you. I've been having this problem with shoplifting on and off for about 10 years. And her jaw dropped open. She had no idea. To her credit, she didn't yell at me. She didn't give me a lecture. She didn't say, I didn't raise you that way. Who the hell are you? What she said was, yes, let's get you to a therapist like today. And thus began my first round of seeing a therapist. And I was in therapy for 9 months till the end of 1990. As fate would have it, I thought I had gotten in just in time before I knew I was likely to be arrested again. But I was arrested again 1 week after I got into therapy in mid-March of 1990. Of course, that added more stress to my life. And my mom was, of course, upset. And now I figured I'm in law school halfway through it, and I'm probably never even going to be able to be a lawyer. So it was very stressful waiting for that court to resolve. But I did end up pulling myself together, getting through the court. And I learned a lot in therapy about what was driving the shoplifting. And it was very helpful. So I had anger that I was displacing. I was trying to be the hero all the time. And I had to learn how to say no and take care of myself. And those were easier said than done. But I was continuing to shoplift even after my court got resolved. And so at the 9 month mark of therapy, my therapist finally said to me, I don't get this. It's like you're addicted to this. And I had a light bulb moment, I swear to you, where I had never thought about shoplifting and addiction in the same thought bubble. I knew about alcohol and drugs and even gambling, but it made sense. After all, my dad was an addict, and, you know, maybe I was more like him than I cared to admit. So that was a turning point. And though I discontinued therapy, I did find an article in the paper the following week about some local support groups for addiction recovery. And I went, and though I was one of the younger people there, and most people had drug and alcohol problems, and I was certainly the only one who was a shoplifter, they took me under their wing. And then eventually I did get my law license. I had to go through a series of interviews. And I had a very well-known attorney who was my next-door neighbor growing up come to bat for me. I had a letter from my therapist because they wanted to know, you know, who is this guy who's stealing, you know, and has a criminal record. And they gave me a chance, and I was licensed to practice law in early 1992. I did that full-time for 3 years. But in late 92, I started a support group called CASA, Kleptomaniacs and Shoplifters Anonymous, in Metro Detroit. And I found that I got help from the group, and the group got help from the group. And this was a missing piece. And that group almost didn't actually get birthed, because I would show up at the church every Wednesday night for 14 consecutive weeks before the first person came through the door. So there's a lesson about persistence. And now the group is coming up on 28 years old, you know, and that eventually led me to go back to get my master's in social work from 1995 to 1997. And then I practiced in the drug and alcohol field at a local clinic for about 7 years. And then 16 years ago in 2004, after I completed my first book, Something for Nothing, Shoplifting Addiction Recovery, I went into private practice. And my main specialty is working with people who compulsively steal. Shoplifting is the most common form of theft. Employee theft, second most common. And then third, people who take from family, friends, sometimes strangers. But it's been a real gift and a real blessing to turn lemons into lemonade. And I have had the joy to write other books and to have many media appearances and to help start support groups throughout the country and beyond. Last year, my book, Something for Nothing, was published in Japanese in Japan, because through my research, this is a global problem. And I'm going to wrap up in a minute. And I know this is a controversial kind of topic, because a lot of people have not thought of stealing as an addiction. We do know there are professional thieves out there. I was not one of those. We do know that people often steal to support an underlying addiction, drugs, alcohol, gambling, and increasingly over shopping, overspending, especially when the credit cards get maxed out. But this can really be an addiction, because it does look like a duck, quacks like a duck, walks like a duck. And sorry to the vegetarians out there, it could taste like a duck. It's got all the same markers. And so now, being in recovery for 30 plus years, I still have to keep an eye on it. But it has allowed me to have a beautiful life. I've been married 18 years, together with my wife, 21. I've been living in the same home here in Metro Detroit for 20 years. I love my career. I love helping people. I've got a lot of friends that I've met over the last 25, 30 years who my life truly and literally is an open book. So I got a lot of good people in my life. And it's just a real joy to educate people about this kind of addictive behavior, because about 10% of Americans, according to some research, have a perpetual problem with stealing. And most are good people. And punishment or white-knuckling it is usually not enough. I'm not saying that everybody who steals is addicted to it, but this kind of way of looking at it often does fit well and is, I think, not a cure, but a solution to arresting the behavior, pun intended, and helping people get to the core of what's going on and make other positive changes. So I'm blessed to be here as a gratefully recovering shoplifter and theft addict. And I want to say thank you for listening, and I'm really looking forward to some good questions.
Thank you, Terrence. That was really cool. Gave me some things to think about. I really enjoyed your relating of the time you got caught. And not to make light of it, but I would have been heavily tempted to lift a Pink Floyd The Wall album too. A great album. But I'm grateful for your relating of that experience, and I will likely ask you a follow-up question on that in a few minutes here, depending on the questions that come in. So before we get to the questions here, and I would just want to remind everybody, in order to ask a question, type it in the Q&A section below at the bottom of your Zoom screen. We'll get to it. But before we do that, I'd like to give you about 60 seconds or so to share with us a little bit more about CASA and why you chose that organization as the one you want any contributions that may come in from this meeting to go to.
Sure. So CASA is 28 years old, and we do have chapters around the country, maybe about, we've got four chapters here in Metro Detroit and maybe about 20 across the country. And it's very hard to get a vibrant group going, in part because of the fear and the shame around stealing, you know, thou shall not steal. And we do rely heavily on court referrals to our programs. I'd say in our Metro Detroit meetings, we have probably 75 to 80% of people are directly court ordered to come as part of their probation, similar to how many people get referred to AA and NA. I did register it as a LLC nonprofit about 10 years ago, officially. And what we do is, and we are authorized by the AA World Headquarters in New York to use the term CASA, Kleptomaniacs and Shoplifters Anonymous, and we incorporate the 12 steps with our meetings. And we do have phone groups that are listed on our website if people don't have a local group in their area. There is a listing of the local groups on my website. And we do have, I do have a private email group for mostly clients of mine to participate. But what we do with our any donations is there are people who call us who are indigent or from jail or prison who maybe want literature sent to them. On occasion, we can get a book sent to them, my book, Something for Nothing, or I wrote a book about employee theft. And also to subsidize sometimes therapy for people who maybe can't pay a full price for therapy. And there's other things we do as well as, copies and postage and things like that.
Awesome. Thank you. Thank you, Terrence. I appreciate that. All right. So we've got a question here from Castle, one of our attendees here. Castle says, Terrence, you are amazing. Thank you so much for sharing. What was it like for you to come to terms with your addiction, being like others may have seen it as not as serious as others that are out there that we may be used to hearing about?
Right. Thank you, Castle. And I haven't had an opportunity to hear your presentation from about a week or so ago, but I will go online and then check that out this weekend. So I'm looking forward. Thank you for being a part of this. So yeah, well, today I have fairly little shame about my past. I really transformed it into gratitude, and my own self-judgment has really dissipated. But it was hard in the beginning because even though I started to realize this was an addiction, and after starting the group, I knew there might be a lot of judgment out there, and particularly as a newly practicing attorney, also around the time that I started the CASA group in late 92, the last thing I wanted was my name out there. And, you know, we have a program of anonymity anyway and confidentiality, when I got the website up, I was bit by bit having various TV shows and programs and magazines and newspapers finding me whenever they wanted to talk about shoplifting or something. And, you know, thus became the question, do I use my full name or whatever? And certainly more recently, when I became a therapist, social worker and addiction therapist 23 years ago, I began to feel a little more comfortable about putting myself out there and speaking a little bit about my story, even using sometimes my face and my last name, which I know for some people is a little problematic. But I also felt like I didn't want to hide, because what I was hoping is if somebody can come forward with their own face and even their own name, that it could really give, it could educate people and help them know what's possible to live just fully. I can't tell you, Castle, how many times I've heard my clients or the people at our CASA group say, how come I couldn't just be an alcoholic? How can I just, everybody understands that, and if you get 30 days clean, everybody pats you on the back. But if you say, hi, I'm a recovering shoplifter, people don't know what to make of that. And they start to check to see if their wallet is on them. I get it. My standard response to that is I get it. And I don't think any addiction is a pleasant experience. And I'm certainly not saying one is worse than another, but in a way, because of drinking and drugs, more people actually die, not only from their own, their own deaths, but cause deaths of others directly and indirectly through their usage. So I said, careful about thinking the grass is greener. All addictions lead to the same place. But my goal and mission, maybe a lifelong one, is to just keep educating people and hope that these CASA groups spring up little bit by bit and the people get educated. And I've never made an excuse where I've said, just because something's an addiction, that it means like you get a free pass or get out of jail free card. No, there's natural consequences. My only thing is to say, if you're going to lump everybody into a category as just a plain thief, you might want to slow down, because that usually isn't accurate and it's not always very helpful. Not usually helpful. So I don't know if I answered your question, Castle, but one of the things I work on is reducing the level of shame. I mean, some clients have to have a little healthy shame in a sense where they don't even feel bad at all about what they're doing, or at least they don't realize they're hurting people. Because many of the people I work with and what I did, I was taking from stores, not a person, and I was taking from work, not a person. And so we can depersonalize it very quickly. But as I've done the research and realized, it has a lot of negative impacts, not only on me, but on everybody. The prices go up and then we complain about it, but we're part of the problem. People lose their jobs, less of a tax base in terms of the profit at the end of the year for many companies, retailers and beyond when there's theft. So whatever you think about taxes, let's assume some of it goes to good use, our public schools, our roads, parks, projects. And it has I myself as one person am not making a huge dent on all the social problems and the financial problems. And I think the biggest thing is, and this is a little off the subject, but we live in a time where the value on honesty and truth and I think something's happening. I mean, there's always been stealing, but I think now, it's really an epidemic. And I've known many people who could be living a very solid recovery program in, let's say, AA or NA, but they may be stealing. They may be shoplifting. They may steal from work. They may be lying on their taxes. They may be doing credit card fraud. So it's somehow easy to compartmentalize, even though we all know recovery is a program of rigorous honesty.
Wow, that's some really good stuff to think about there, Terrence. So you're opening my eyes to some concepts that I had never thought about before. You know, I've always... or I don't know about always, but oftentimes I think a thief's a thief and a thief needs to be, locked away that way, and haven't really equated the addiction side to thing and that's really cool. Thank you for sharing that. All right. I got another question here. As an addiction therapist, what are some similarities? And I think you've touched on this already, but between the core of, at least on the surface, vastly different addictions.
Okay. One of my favorite sayings is all addictions are in the same family, and there's a lot of similarities, and all recoveries, even though, it may not even be a 12-step recovery, there's different ways to format your recovery and everybody's recovery is going to be unique. And there's a lot of the same kinds of things involved. But in a way, all addictions are unique. Even within chemical addiction, we have NA groups, which are possibly more for drugs rather than alcohol, some differences. We even have Marijuana Anonymous, there's a Cocaine Anonymous, so there's some differences. Even with gambling, which recently kind of moved into the DSM-5, the book of psychological disorders that gets updated every 15 to 20 years, that actually got moved from the impulse control disorder category, where kleptomania is, into the substance use disorder, SUD, category with drugs and alcohol. So they're even moving a behavioral addiction into a category. So I don't want to go too quickly and throw the baby out with the bathwater, because I know some people will say, are we calling everything an addiction now? We got to be a little careful, don't we? But if gambling addiction is accepted as a legitimate addiction, then almost any behavior can. So shopping addiction is not yet fully recognized, though that is something I also work with and treat. Hoarding, while that also made it in, hoarding disorder is not exactly an addiction, but there are 12-step groups called Clutterers Anonymous, and it can mimic an addiction in a number of ways, and recovery is often the key, ongoing recovery. I think specialization is important in terms of addiction treatment. Because even if you're a great addiction therapist, it's almost impossible to understand the nuances of the different addictions out there. That's why there are eating disorder specialists, gambling addiction specialists, sex addictions. So I think we're moving into a world where it's almost maybe too subspecialized. But that's primarily what I treat, is the stealing behaviors, secondarily shopping and spending problems, thirdly hoarding. So again, I don't know if I answer your question, but we do know the days where people go into treatment or recovery with having only one addictive behavior are few and far between. So many treatment centers are getting wise to this, and they're realizing if you go for a gambling problem or a sex problem, they educate about all these different addictions. And sometimes people reveal that they have had or currently have. And we're always trying to warn people about not trading Peter for Paul. So and that does happen a lot. But anyway, great question. I hope I answered it adequately.
Awesome. Thank you. Thank you very much. I have another question come in from our audience. Heather says, thank you so much, Terrence, for sharing your story. Your journey is inspiring to me. I'm curious, what literature do you use in CASA?
So while we do kind of have the CASA name, each group is a bit independent in terms of what kind of literature. One of the things we've been trying to work on is getting some kind of a universal national literature. But whether the phone groups, there's 10 different phone groups, weekly phone groups that are free and listed on my website, and they're bracketed in different groups, and they have different people who facilitate it and in different ways, and they have developed their own literature. So there is some information on our website. There is my book. There are some other books out there too. We use some different forms of literature at our local meetings, which we are now doing by phone for the last 4 months during the COVID crisis. But if you have any desire for literature, I would suggest you first go and look at the website, and you can copy anything and print out anything. My book has a lot of good stuff in it. You're welcome to copy anything from the book and use it for your personal use. And if you wanted me to mail you or email you some literature, you can contact me by phone, email, or you know, in the mail, and I will get you some of what I have. But we're still kind of working on some kind of national kind of literature. There are a couple groups that are called Shoplifters Anonymous. We stopped using that name for our website because there was a little bit of a trademark and copyright to kind of battle with a company from New York about 10 years ago. And we just now use kleptomaniacsanonymous.org. But I do want to just say, everybody has heard the term kleptomania. And certainly that was what I thought I might be initially. But in my research then, and even more in the last 30 years, kleptomania is a very, 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 very rare condition affecting maybe 0.5% of the population, mostly women. And it's a little bit different than what I call addictive compulsive stealing, even though addictive compulsive stealing or theft addiction for shorthand is not yet recognized. My hope is that that could maybe be included in the DSM or more broadly, because a lot of times kleptomania has different kind of criteria. It's more of an impulse control disorder than a compulsive disorder. And there's other differences too, but anyway, I'll stop there, but I hope I answered that question too.
Awesome. Thank you, Terrence. I put a couple of links in the chat for your website there. So those who are live here can do that. I'll put it in the show notes for the podcast listeners so that they can go to that.
Yeah.
All right. I've got another question here that I'm going to go to the one that I first referenced when I started off this segment with the first time you got caught. So my question is, do you think that a heavier punishment, perhaps your mom being informed at that time or something like that, would have woken you up a little bit quicker to your situation? Or do you think that would have continued no matter what?
Right. Well, you know, I can't say for sure. It's all speculation and hypothetical. But probably for me, not. I think that would have just, I think getting me into therapy right away was probably the best thing. I don't think, in general, I don't think yelling at somebody. I've had a number of clients who've theorized that if my folks had been harder on me, maybe, you know, but then I've had many clients who said, I think they were too lenient on me. You know, so or they should have been more lenient, you know, on me. So it's all speculation, but I think what we know in general, and again, I just had a client who I've been working with for a few years who had a relapse about 8 months ago, and she was given a long time to, you know, be on an electronic tether and probation. And she just went to court this morning, and both her attorney and I were both feeling like she'd probably get her probation continued, but the judge ended up putting her in jail for 6 months. And I just found that out this morning. So every judge might be different in terms of how he or she sees it, every prosecutor. And there are a lot of defense attorneys who don't understand this. And they sometimes, I've heard from clients, will make a comment like, I can't believe you got caught again. You know, I'm glad you're calling me to pay me, but you know, what are you, stupid? You know, I mean, that they've literally said that. And I've had clients who've gone to a therapist, maybe even an addiction therapist, and say, I think I have a shoplifting problem. And they'll get a strange look, or they will quickly find out that the person doesn't know really what to do with this. They may just simply say, well, can't you just avoid stores? And that's like the whole solution. That's like telling the alcoholic, can't you just avoid people who drink? Well, even if you could, you know, which is improbable, that's not what all of recovery is about. It's much deeper than that, you know. I'm not a parent myself, so I'm very sensitive about what each parent or parents think is the best way. But I often am fond of saying, play the middle. So don't underkill and don't overkill. Address it early. There may be some consequence that is appropriate, but also it's a teachable moment, or usually it's a sign, not always, but usually, that something is going on. But I understand the tendency to treat it as a bad behavior that you want to correct quickly. And that may help with some people. I'm not saying it might not, but often it doesn't really investigate or go, because often kids and adults, and basically adults are big kids, we're displacing our anger. It might be, so taking it out that way, we're filling a void. We're anxious and we're using it as a mood regulator. We're depressed and we're using it as a pick-me-up. There's a rush, a high, relief. There's all kinds of things we might be getting out of it. And there might be financial issues. It might be a sign that my boundaries are being violated in some way, and I'm now violating other boundaries of the law and of other people. So I'm not saying we have to overanalyze and overthink it, but I think even though the program says keep it simple, I think often it is more complicated, at least to begin with.
Thanks, Terrence. I have one more question. And if anybody else has another question they want to type it in the Q&A. We'll get to it here after my question. If not, we'll close up after that. But my question is, and you referenced this once in the talk, and then I think just now in this question, you kind of did, not using this word, but what does white knuckling look like to you and others you work with?
So, by the way, I forget if I'm on video here, but I do want to also just promote unsteal.org, which is a nonprofit out of California that I'm associated with for 5 years now, that is a way for people to make amends directly to the store through a middleman, through donating up to $200 on the website unsteal.org, where we will get it to a particular store without your identity being known. And so
that's cool.
But anyway, so white knuckling, it can look at a lot of different ways. I mean, obviously, I don't know if it's obvious, but we're trying. I still have thoughts and urges from time to time, and I know kind of a little bit what my kind of common triggers and issues are that I got to keep an eye on. But white knuckling is, just trying to either avoid stores, which is a good idea, but I'm a realist. Most people are going to need to do it, or just trying to, just hold on for dear life and not steal. If you're having that many urges, that usually means there's either some core wounding that really needs to kind of, be understood and worked on. Or again, if you're just trying to hold on for dear life, I'm not sure if I'm articulating it right, but people will often share about how hard it is to ask for help. So they white knuckle it by trying to go it alone, whether it's a financial stress or something. And I often say, look, pride goeth before the fall. You could ask for help, whatever it be, on the front end, or eventually you're going to ask for even 10 times or 20 times more help when you're making a call from jail and somebody's got to bail you out. So don't white knuckle it. And that can also mean with spirituality, letting go, letting God, accepting your imperfections, stop trying to be perfect. Because I think what a lot of people do, and I was guilty of this early on, is once I, got into recovery, I thought, okay, now I've got to kind of like get back to the old Terry who, maybe before he even stole, and be the good kid that I am, and now I've got to make amends and be even better for all the stress and worry I put people through. And that is understandable, but I was actually going in the problem the same way that got me there. Instead of realizing I'm vulnerable, I have feelings, I have needs. It's okay to say no. It's okay for me to self-care in an appropriate way. It's okay to ask for help. So I don't have to white knuckle my recovery. And that's a similar kind of thing. I don't know if I specifically said about the stealing, but there are plenty of people who are white knuckling it. Let's just say that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And one more question came in, and this is a multi-tiered question. So it might be one that you'll get to follow up on here in a little bit. This came in from Kayla. Kayla says, hello, Mr. Terrence. How can I know if something is wrong with me or if it is just a spur of the moment occasion? Because last year I lived close to a store where I would steal from nearly daily. I thought I was sick. Any time I was alone at that store, I couldn't help myself. Is it like a mental disorder? Am I built wrong?
That's a good question. So while I don't know your whole life story, I often work from the assumption that basically we're decent people. And when we're acting in a way, whether it's breaking the law or being dishonest or being deceitful, or in this case, stealing, I'm usually giving people the benefit of the doubt and saying that something's going on that you're not managing in a healthy or effective way. And the stealing is like a signal to you, and eventually maybe to others, that something is going wrong or going not well in your inner world. And so we look to that. And so often people, like I work with people who've been stealing from an early age. I work with people who started stealing in middle age. And I work with late onset people who maybe never stole anything, let's say, until after 50 or beyond. And, you know, the way I look at life is it's kind of cumulative. You know, it's kind of like the straw that broke the camel's back. You may have been like just holding on, talk about white knuckling it. And then finally, that one little flat tire that happens to you is what puts you over the stress edge. And then you're off doing some bizarre behavior that maybe you hadn't done before. But a lot of times, if you look at what's going on in your life contemporaneously to the start of your shoplifting or your stealing, you will often find pretty ready clues. So you hear things about money problems, relationship problems, health problems, worrying about family and kids, divorce, abuse, traumatic events, unfairnesses, even worrying about the world. So we know during COVID, there may, obviously for people who are in recovery, it's a tough time, but there are a lot of people who maybe never had a drinking problem, but now they're starting to have a drinking problem. Never had a shopping problem, but now they're shopping too much, particularly online. Never had a stealing problem. So, you know, you can even if your own life is going halfway okay, you know, we are a product and connected to the world. So I don't know if I answered the question, Kayla, but I don't think I'm going to assume you're not a bad person. You're doing a bad behavior, let's say. And I'm glad you're aware of that and participating here. So I would suggest if you haven't looked at my website, go there, read. There's video clips. Read my book. Confide in a close family or friend person. Go on the CASA free phone group meetings. Find a therapist, hopefully somebody who, if they can't find anybody locally who works with this particular addiction, try to suss it out and see if they're open or if they've ever dealt with this. But you're not alone. A lot of people start there, and if you can catch it early, that would be ideal.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Terrence. This was a very informative and great RICO 12 weekly speaker meeting for all addicts and those wanting to learn more about addiction and the recovery therefrom, from all sorts of addictions. And I love the variety that we get in here. So to our audience, if we didn't get to your question, or if you have other questions, please go to RICO12.com/forum. And join our community and ask those questions and answer others' questions that will come up there. I invite the audience to come back next week. If you have not yet gone to RICO12.com and submitted your email address, you only need to do that once. Please get on the invitation list so you can join us live each Friday at noon Central Time. If you'd like to join me, I'm going to close us up in the Thomas Merton prayer, which I think is a really cool one in that. And then we'll close this up. My Lord God, I have no idea where I am going. I do not see the road ahead of me. I cannot know for certain where it will end, nor do I really know myself. And the fact that I think that I am following your will does not mean that I am actually doing so. But I believe that the desire to please you does, in fact, please you. And I hope I have that desire in all that I am doing. I hope that I will never do anything apart from that desire. And I know that if I do this, you will lead me by the right road, though I may know nothing about it. Therefore, will I trust you always, though I may seem to be lost and in the shadow of death. I will not fear, for you are ever with me, and you will never leave me to face my perils alone. Thanks, everybody. Keep coming back. It works if you work it, so work it. You're worth it. Thank you so much, Terrence. This was awesome.
Yeah, and remember, as the title of my book says, though I did not invent the phrase, there's no such thing as something for nothing, or at least very rarely. But, you know, you're going to pay for it in the end, and it could be with an arrest. It could be just your self-esteem is compromised, your relationships, your peace of mind. And there's no price tag you can put on peace of mind. And we forget that, but I think we really know it. And recovery reminds me of that virtually daily. That my peace of mind, my reputation, my self-esteem is my most precious commodity.
Beautiful. Thank you very much, Terrence. Everybody have a great week. We'll talk to you. We'll see y'all soon.
Thank you. Thank you, Justin.
this life of mine. Peaks too high to conquer, streams too wide to cross, troughs too deep to walk through without incurring loss. Yet here I am, still standing tall, despite the rough terrain. One like me survive the storms and walk through wind and rain. Still standing, I will fight the good fight. Still searching for glimmers of light. Feet still on the ground. I can still be found standing still.
Bind it with the sea.